Ladies and gentlemen, what can I say about these august men, these titans among rock and rollers? Dave McCulloch's, Jude Carr's, mine and yours, the band for the future, the 80s or 90s, who knows, U2.
All right, hello, welcome to the official At U2 podcast, episode number 5, talking all things U2, including new album news, tour dates, and community discussions from the staff of At U2. Once again, I'm joined by Mr. Matt McGee, owner, proprietor, chief bottle washer at U2.com. Hello.
How are you? What was that? What was that opening clip? That was fantastic.
Well, that, according to YouTube, if you believe the internet, which I do, everything is true on the internet, that is the audio of the introduction to U2's first television appearance on, I believe, the Late Late Show. I forget the host name. Somebody's going to be mad at me right now because I don't remember it off the top of my head. David something, but he doesn't remember. He doesn't actually know U2, so he asked a journalist to introduce them, and that's what he said.
Oh, so, that's awesome.
Before they played, they went into Stories for Boys, which sounds, if you've never ever listened, I'll go find that link or the video and throw it in the show notes so you can go watch it again. Because if you've never watched that appearance, it, and then you've just recently watched maybe one of their recent tour appearances, it's a startling kind of contrast, but you can see like a little glimmer of where they're coming from. So,
yes.
And also joining us on this episode, first time at U2, Christopher Endrenol. Did I get that right?
Endrenol. Yeah, Endrenol. Right. Yeah. You got it.
A fellow Chris, a fellow U2 fan. So tell us a little bit about where you are in the world and what your involvement is with At U2.
I am currently in Fort Myers, Florida. I teach music theory at Florida Gulf Coast University. I've been on the staff of At U2 since 2011. I saw the call for staff members, I think it was late 2010 or early 2011. And I have, of course, a personal connection to U2's music because I love it, but I also have a professional connection to their music because I wrote my music theory dissertation on U2's music. So I've got a personal and a professional connection to this band we all love so much.
Nice. And so that was a while ago now, right?
Yeah, it was, I finished it in 2008.
Okay. And do you get it like a passing grade or is it a...
actually at the end of my defense, my committee said that I did fine, and after just a few revisions, I would be Dr. Endrenol. So,
oh, there
that
you was go. Cool.
Yeah,
that is awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
Doctor of U2. That's awesome.
That's actually what my mother-in-law said I got my PhD in for a while. She said I got my doctorate in U2, which would be pretty awesome if that were the case.
Yeah, right? How cool is that?
Yeah,
it'll happen, I'm sure, eventually here.
Doctor U2 studies, sure.
Good. All right, we thought we'd mention briefly, just because we had some questions maybe about this. We're the At U2 podcast is not recorded live in studio. Maybe if you listen to the U talking U2 to me and you or whatever, that podcast, the interview with that they actually had with the band, they're in studio. We don't have that luxury. We're actually just recording over Skype and things. So we've actually never met. Some of us have met. I've never met most of them, all of them, I think. So just so you're aware, I guess, of how podcasting maybe works, is if the At U2 podcast is your introduction to the world of podcasting, we're just sitting in each of our basements or our offices or wherever, talking into microphones, staring at the wall, and just having right. a chat that you're happy to eavesdrop on. And
it's pretty safe to say that no member of U2 is about to walk in and join any of us in our podcasting tonight.
Not tonight. Not this time.
Yeah. Not my I don't know about you guys, but my basement office is not quite the illustrious Electric Ladyland studios that they're in. All right. So on that note, let's jump right into checking our inbox feedback and questions we've had to the hashtag Ask at U2. And first one is from at Charoff. U2 is the only group I know of that adds snippets to their songs. Have they always done this? Is it on purpose? Matt, how about you? What do you think of this?
It's funny. That's if I ever get a chance to interview Bono, that's one of the questions that I'm going to ask him. Yeah. You know, not when did you start? Because we actually know when he started. If you go to tours.atu2.com, you can kind of start digging through early dates. And as far according to our records, the very first snippet was September 7th, 1980, London. He did a snippet of "Send in the Clowns" during the Electrico. So have they always done it? Yeah, they've always done it. He's always done it since 1980. This started, and So I'd love to know why. Like, what prompted him at that point to start doing the snippet? And now it's kind of become, you know, you guys have been to shows. It's kind of become, I think, a way that he sort of pays, you know, name checks people who are in the building and pays tribute to some of his favorite artists. So, you know, like I think Roger Daltrey was at one of the New York shows, so he did a bunch of Who snippets, and you know, Bruce Springsteen was at the last show, so he did a snippet of Hungry Heart and all that sort of stuff. So, it's fascinating that that it's, you know, since 1980 he's been doing this, and I'd love to ask him, like, what prompted you, and you know, why do you continue to do it so often?
Yeah, I think it's really cool. I love it when he does this. I also know of a couple other bands, in particular the Counting Crows. I've seen them several times live, and I know that Adam Duritz uses snippets from other songs and other artists and other Counting Crows songs when he sings. And I find it fascinating how these frontmen can just weave in lyrics and melodies from other songs and even other artists almost on the spot. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think like that's one of the things I'd ask Bono too, is like how much of it is, you know, prepared and planned versus, you know, kind of spur of the moment thing. Because there were some shows on this tour where he would see a sign in the audience. Like I think there was one show where somebody was holding up a sign saying "Ultraviolet, light my way," and so he's saying, you know, "Baby, baby, baby, light my way," or something like that. And so, yeah, and it just—I mean, it just sounds like it fits so naturally. So, yeah, that's a cool question.
Yeah, and that's sort of like the rehearsed spontaneity thing that they often sort of do, right, where like making it feel like it's the first time they've ever done this, but then it actually isn't. And wondering like, okay, do they say like, "Okay, Edge, I'm going to do this little snippet here of this song, so just play a little longer for this part." And that's where, as a musician, I'm always curious how that interplay works, because you don't get to see often, like say on tour videos and stuff, there you don't get those close-ups necessarily on those moments or whatever of between Edge and Bono or whatever. And so it's always, I'm just like you, I'm curious how that all goes down and plays out backstage or beforehand and things like that. So,
all right.
Next question was from @Wilo74. Any news, rumor on what's happening with the Dublin IE shows? Seems weird that they have still not been confirmed.
Yeah, it is weird. It is weird. I think, you know what? I think, well, I mean, we know they've kind of said in some interviews, you know, previously that the problem is that this production doesn't fit in the, what's it called now, the 3 Arena. Used to, it's, you know, on the site of the Point Depot. That's, you know, they've redone it a few times, I think. It doesn't fit there, because that arena is, unlike North American arenas, that arena is already sort of on its side, if that makes sense. So like the stage instead of being the stage at one end in that arena, the stage is sort of, I'm doing a terrible job of describing this. Anyway, the floor, edit all that out, Chris, right?
We'll fix that in post.
The layout of that arena just is not going to work for this production that they have. So I think they've said that they have to either, you know, do a completely different show or find some other way to do it. My guess is that they're going to announce it, but I mean, they're really good at announcing shows when, you know, in conjunction with momentum that they have. So I don't think there'll be any announcements until the European tour starts. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some announcement right after the tour begins. Next month, because there'll be all sorts of media attention on them, you know, first shows of the leg. And that's when, you know, that's how they do things. That's when they will make an announcement if they're ready to make such an announcement.
Yeah. Or coinciding maybe with like a new album release or something along those lines that may happen or whatever at some point down the road. But yeah, definitely you have to know that they will do a show in Dublin. Worst case scenario, they strip the tour back and do something outdoors or whatever, who knows, but definitely will happen. All right, at Jose Cazares 7, have subscription gifts been mailed out yet? I'm assuming this is related to the UT.com subscription, maybe? Is that what's...
I think so, yeah, and I have seen people online post pictures and videos of their freshly pressed vinyl, but I have not gotten it here in Southwest Florida. Actually waiting, though.
Yeah, it has arrived here in Eastern Washington, at least at U2 headquarters. I have not opened it, however, because I don't have a record player to play it. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of strange that, you know, who's getting and who's not. And I would suggest to anyone listening, Sherry Lawrence from our staff was tweeting quite a bit about it today, about, you know, trying to get information about, you know, has it shipped or has it not shipped and when is it going to ship and all that sort of stuff. So you might connect with her on Twitter. She's at ATU2COM Sherry on Twitter. So you might connect with her if you have questions about that.
Yeah. And definitely, yeah, we'll be sure to post anything that we hear in the future about that. But I'm sure anxious for fans awaiting subscription gifts. Last question for this segment anyways from JabW10. I never know how to say some of these. Who are our Euro contacts / who to follow for the next leg of the tour? Matt, any guesses or suggestions?
Well, that's the cool thing about how things work in Europe is that there's, you know, pretty much, you know, most of the big countries there, there's a dedicated fan site for each country. So, for the German shows, obviously U2Tour.de is going to have a big presence there, I'm sure. And there's French website, U2Octung.com, I believe, is one of the French sites. U2 Gigs, I believe, is based in Germany, I think Matthias is. And so I'm sure they're going to be at a bunch of shows. There's Italian fan sites and Greek fan sites. So there's, I mean, that's one of the really cool things about when they're in Europe is that there's different websites, able to give some real cool coverage of specific shows.
And certainly the at U2 pod or Twitter account podcast.
Oh, yeah.
But we'll retweet stuff. And
I apologize. We have some staff over in Europe as well. Duh. Wow.
I didn't want to point out the obvious because you are the boss.
Gosh, you just fire me now. Holy smokes. So anyway, yeah, we have some staff over in Europe. And so some of our folks will be going to shows as well. And so we'll be posting videos and, you know, concert recaps and tweeting and photos and all that sort of stuff as best we can from the shows that our crew is going to.
Yeah, and obviously time zones and things will play a factor in that as somebody's awake and somebody's not. And I'm sure just like in North America here, there'll be plenty of periscopes and people doing meerkatting and stuff from the shows. And exciting to see, as we've talked about many times already on this show, is exciting to see how they change. They will change the show for Europe and what elements get dropped, what elements get added, all that kind of stuff is just kind of fun and not like days gone by where we had to wait for the tour documentary DVD to come out or someone to bootleg a shaky webcam for a view from a concert out to us. We'll be able to probably see it as it happens. So very cool. All right. So our next segment is the At U2 Roundtable, where we gather a few folks from the At U2 staff and chat about events going on in the U2 world. This week, we're going to sort of piggyback part two, I guess, of our discussion we had last week about the 20th anniversary at U2 party. And Matt already had his say, so he doesn't get to talk.
But based on my performance so far tonight, that's a good idea.
But we do have, much like I think it was episode 3, we have a pre-recorded segment I did with Sherry, who is obviously at the show, the concert, the party, and a little discussion about how it all came together as in her role as sort of organizer and helper of putting things together. That's probably not her official title, but anyways, I'll play her chat that I had with her, and then we'll pick it up on the other side.
That's a real Zoo TV moment.
Well, I am known as the party girl on staff. So we had trash trampoline and the party girl. Marilyn was trash. Michelle Watson was trampoline. And I'm always the party girl on staff if you wanted to introduce me as such.
Well, welcome to the podcast again, Sherry, the party girl of At U2. You were on last episode, so I won't do the big long introduction, but welcome back to the show. And
thank you.
We are especially happy to be chatting with you because we had some exciting stuff happen at the At U2 20th anniversary party last week that I'm sure most of the listeners or readers of atu2.com are well aware of. But in case you haven't heard it all, Sherry was the one who sort of helped piece some of the pieces together, I guess. And so I wanted to chat with you. You wanted to come on and sort of chat about some of how that all went down from the organizational planning perspective. So walk me through, I don't know where a good place to start is in terms of your Wednesday activities.
Yeah, well, to begin with, I am probably the most irrational U2 fan you'll probably ever meet. So I like to dream big, and I thought, if you don't ask, then the answer will always be no. So when the African Well Fund approached us about the potential of handing Bono personally his birthday card, I thought, well, let's just ask. The worst that could happen is no. But if we don't ask, then the answer will most definitely be no. So they submitted their request, and then I submitted another request on top of that, so that management knew that we were open to having this as a possibility. Being the event organizer, we were okay with the charity of choice that we were benefiting using our event. So the opening line that I used in both email and in print was, Bono has announced from the stage that U2 is available for weddings and bar mitzvahs. How about birthday parties? And that's how it started. You know, it kind of helped following the tour around and knowing what the Bonoisms were. And that was the line that stuck with me. So throughout the whole process, we were told, you know, you have a million and one shot. There's no way with the schedules and security and this, that, and the other. Maybe we could do like a video hookup or you know, the band really loves you guys, but we just don't think it's going to work. And I was like, okay, you know, the rational side of me was saying, I get that. I understand that they're very busy people and all things considered, we're small potatoes in the grand scheme of things. And then that day on Wednesday, they were doing an interview with Sirius XM for the upcoming town hall that they're broadcasting on the Spectrum station this upcoming Friday, August 7th. And then Edge and Bono were out on Ellis Island doing an Art for Amnesty presentation with Yoko Ono. So, you know, looking at their schedule, I'm like, yeah, you know, they're going to be busy. There's no way. And then I got pinged via email with a list of management and PR people along with a, you know, once again, we're sorry, but the band can't show up. And I was like, okay, I get that. And that's the irrational side of me. But the irrational side of me was like, they are not going to let us down. I asked big. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. Come on. This has got to happen.
So even though, I'll just interject and ask some of the questions. So even though you're getting all signs saying no, there's still a part of you that's saying yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Deep in the deepest depths of my heart, I'm like, they would not let us down. Please, 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 please. And so, you know, throughout the night, as things were happening, you know, I didn't want to accept that it wasn't going to happen. You know, and that's quite irrational when everybody's telling you no, and you're saying, oh, no, 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 no. It's a yes. It's a yes. It's got to be a yes. So as Matt wrote in this past Sunday's OTR about the whole schedule of things that happened when Dallas showed up, and he sort of acted as a foil. He and I were on VIP patrol, so you know we're building a relationship with the new management team since the transfer from principal management happened. So we were waiting at the door to greet the new team coming in to say thank you for, you know, letting us stay online, you know, let us buy you a drink, let's do this. And so Matt was told, no, you don't need to stay at the door. And we know our way around. We know what the people like to drink. We know that you're being very hospitable and your hospitality is wonderful, but you don't need to be at the door. Well, I didn't get that memo because I'm stood at the top of the staircase waiting to accept the VIPs in to personally bring them to our little area. So all of a sudden, I see the side door fling open and up comes band security, whom I recognized. And I'm going, oh my God, what, wait. And so as one security member passed by me, I saw Adam. I'm like, oh, it's Adam. Oh, my God. And then I saw another security person. And then behind him, it was Edge. I'm like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. And then the line stopped. And I got to be honest with you. I'm going, wait a minute. Is Bono and Larry coming separately? It didn't click that it was only these two. And they were the ones who I really didn't invite. Because we had invited Bono. You know? Like, they're not going to take the African Well Fund's birthday card. Wait a minute. So as I'm stood there trying to get all of the logistics in my head saying, okay, so how is the Well Fund going to get their card? Wait a minute. The band just walked right by me. What am I doing stood here? So I didn't know that they were being whisked directly to the stage. So I'm following back in their footsteps to make sure that nobody else saw them come up, which they didn't. So by standing where I stood, I was providing extra screen so that people couldn't see past me to see what was really going on. So by the time I got over to our VIP area, that was when Edge had taken the stage and Adam was just coming on stage. So I hightailed it down the flight of stairs past all of their security to help with the surge that had happened around the side of the stage as everybody's taking pictures and the roar was incredible. So I'm trying to push the people back into the rest of the venue to give a bit of space. And then I realized, well, maybe I shouldn't be stood here. Even though I am the event organizer and I have every right to stand here, I don't want to upset band security by being in an area that I just told everybody you can't be in. So I go over and I high five Matt, and Matt is completely stunned. He is standing there in this state of shock, as is just about the rest of the At U2 staff. The Unforgettable Fire folks are also in this place of amazement, which you all can see on the videos that are online. But I'm still in event planning mode, so I go up the stairs and I realize, okay, good, we got the Periscope stream going. My husband is videoing it for us, because I usually videotape all of my events anyway. Since I'm working them, I don't get to see how it all works out. So that's how At U2 was able to have up our video of the whole thing from up in the balcony, because he was already recording the event as it was happening for our own personal use anyway. So I stood there and I was still trying to figure out, is this really happening? They actually did come. And then I'm thinking, oh, well, they got in. How are they going to get out now that everybody knows that they're here?
Right.
So I spent the rest of the time making sure that their exit path remained clear, which it did. But I was still in the moment of, this is my event. I need to make sure that everybody is safe and secure and that everything goes off smoothly. So I didn't get a chance to really enjoy it until after the event concluded and I was watching it on video, even though I was there, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a part of me was like, you know, anybody who thinks that I really knew that this was happening, do you think I would have been positioned where I was positioned? Hell no. I would have been down there with everybody having a blast with everybody else, but it all happened so fast. And once they left, I was talking with the people at the cutting room who worked there, and they were getting pinged left, right, and center from musician friends and industry people saying, I heard what happened at the cutting room. Oh my God, why didn't you tell us? Well, they didn't know either.
Yeah.
They had no idea. So, the highest, form of respect that happened that night was that the fans didn't climb up on the stage. They didn't, I mean, as much as they pushed towards it, they didn't rush the stage. So Adam and Edge could perform. There was no real security issue. People were respectful. People were excited and thrilled. And even the own staff at the cutting room said, never in all their years of doing shows there have they ever heard a roar go through their facility so loud and with such passion as what happened when everybody realized Edge and Adam were on stage, nor could they believe that there were no security incidents that had happened. And that is high praise for the U2 fans that follow these guys, for all of our staff who helped coordinate it. And for me, that's the satisfaction in knowing it was a job well done. But yeah, like I said, I was in complete event planning mode from beginning to just about the end. And it didn't really impact me until a few days later that, oh my God, they actually did come. The irrational fan side of me won out. Take that, rational brain. The heart wins. The heart wins all the time.
And so they literally, and like this is a conversation that will be interjected in the roundtable discussion that we'll have with some of the other at U2 staffers that were there. But so we may have talked about some of this already, but they literally just came to the stage and then left. And not, I don't mean that in like a, those jerks, but I like, because it's incredible that they came in the first place, but it was literally that quick. Like it wasn't, they didn't around and have a drink with you guys or something.
Oh,
it was just like, now we're gone.
No. The Unforgettable Fire, they got pictures, guitar was autographed, all that stuff, but that was very much done in the moment in front of everybody, which was awesome. We had the opportunity to at least do a couple handshakes, a pat on the back, but that was it. It was in, out, boom, done. And that's the only way that it could have happened. There's no way, had they hung around for even a minute, people would have figured out where they were and all that stuff. And kudos to the Unforgettable Fire. They kept the show going. They didn't really break their character, so to speak. You know, they didn't have a complete and utter freak out. They played along professionally and brilliantly, and kudos to them. It was because of their ability to keep the music going that everything went as smoothly as they did. So I've got high praise for them and just high praise for the fans who came out that night. You all showed such respect towards Adam and Edge and all of the staff there, and to U2's own crew, management, PR at Maverick and Nasty Little Man and RMP, who all organized this. And from the look of it, it looked like they had organized this for a long period of time. And they kept the secret, and I'm glad that they did. But I would have appreciated just a little tip off, like even 3 minutes ahead of time, so I could have been somewhere else. But, you know, always the bridesmaid and never the bride.
Yeah, well, there's always like the 25th like, anniversary party.
Yeah, exactly. But it definitely felt a little bit like a scene out of Spinal Tap. You know, it was just everything came together so brilliantly, but I wasn't where I really wanted to be.
Listen, man, I don't need a lemon at all. I'm with the band.
Okay, thanks, Sherry, for your feedback and story on how things went down at the 20th anniversary party, and definitely your role in organizing that. I know, Matt, you had a few comments on that.
Yeah, it's I don't know. It's amazing. If you've never put on an event, it's hard to really understand how much work goes into it. I remember the very first event we did when Sherry was on board, and I just thought, okay, so we're gonna. I think it was like the, maybe it was the album parties for How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. I could be wrong on that. Sherry would correct me if she was. But anyway, you know, so I'm just saying, all right, we're just gonna have a little party. We've got a place reserved, and you know, this is what time it starts, and we're gonna play some music, and we're gonna, you know, and we're gonna order some food, and that's it. And that's all I thought was involved. And thank God she was along organizing this stuff, because there's so many moving parts that have to go into an event like the party that we had in New York a couple weeks ago, just to make everything come together and fit right. And she is, I mean, she's so talented at this, and literally it would not be possible if she was not on the staff. And so just, you know, hopefully she'll tune in. I don't know if she listens to the YouTube podcast. I hope she does.
It's in the contract, isn't it?
No, I don't require that.
Okay.
But like, seriously, we all owe her such a huge, huge thanks and gratitude because she busts her butt to put these events on, and they just go so flawlessly, and people have no idea the amount of planning and organization and scheming and all that sort of stuff that goes on behind the scenes. And she and Steve, her husband too. I mean, he's part and parcel of it as well. The two of them, they had, you know, just all the little decorations. Like there were little, Chris, weren't there? There were little, like mirror ball. What were,
yeah.
Little,
oh, what, little
like
lemon
desktops.
Mirror ball centerpieces on the tables. It was,
yeah,
it was just little
just,
details like that. Really,
exactly.
Really
she thinks of all the she thinks of all the little details, and not a stone gets unturned to put these events on and make them memorable. And so, you know, she's awesome. And thank you, Sherry. Everyone, you know, needs to give her thanks for that. So
yeah, I think it speaks volumes about her planning. The fact that the party went really, really smoothly and everyone had a great time. Of course, because I mean, you know, Edge and Adam showed up, obviously, but I mean, had they not, it still would have been a fantastic party. So
that's true.
Kudos.
And Chris ends. We need to talk about who we have on the podcast with.
Well, I know that was the perfect segue there. You've heard, if you play the video at all, the At You Two video from when Edge and Adam appeared, you no doubt heard Christopher's moderate excitement, I guess, is a good way to put it.
You are being kind.
And I'll throw it in here. I don't have the clip right now as we're chatting, but I'll throw a little audio clip in there of Christopher so people can know exactly what we're talking about. And definitely link obviously to the video so you can watch that, but Christopher, you were, I guess, describe that moment that at U2 party, that when you realized it was actually Adam and the Edge that were playing and not just fake Adam and fake the Edge.
Right. Well, it started, the excitement started building when I and a few of the other at U2 staffers saw Dallas at the side of the stage, and we were all fixated. We're like, oh my god, that's a member of the inner circle here at our party. That's really cool. And you know, he was messing with guitars, and so we were thinking, oh, Dallas is gonna play. That's cool. That's really, really neat. So we were so fixated on Dallas that we didn't see Adam and Edge walk in literally right behind us. They walked in behind us and walked down the stairs to the stage. So Dallas was a perfect distraction. And then Edge walked on stage, and I don't remember much except losing my mind, because you know that's the most close that's the closest I've ever been to Edge, and you know it was such an intimate atmosphere, and for them to just literally just walk on stage and start playing was mind blowing. I watched the video again today, taking a break from school stuff, and I was giggling. Because it was just such a crazy, crazy experience. And, you know, of course I'm sure the rest of the staff had hoped that the band would do something, would give a shout out or, you know, maybe show up and you know, show their face or something. But hope is different from expectation. And I didn't expect the band to come at all. So to have two of the members not only show up, but play two songs, it's a moment that I'll never forget.
And that's where somebody like, for myself, who's just watched the video, and when you're watching the video on YouTube, like, you already know what's going to happen because I see in the title the Edge and Adam Clayton surprise. So like, I know that they're going to walk on stage, and so even seeing Dallas Shue appear, I was just like, well, yeah, that's, he's there because he's checking the gear for the Edge. And that's what I think, what I wanted to ask last week and forgot, but just for you guys who are there, it is like, like for me watching, I was like, well, obviously Dallas is leading up to the Edge and that's what's going to happen. And then the crowd's going to go nuts. But like, just Dallas walking on stage was like a kind of a blow your mind kind of cool thing in its own right, right?
It was, yeah. And you know, again, to answer all the skeptics, we had no idea that Edge and Adam were going to show up, which is why I said, oh my God, about a billion times. Because had we known, obviously my reaction would have been different. But what you saw on the video and what you heard was just, it was 400 diehard U2 fans getting the surprise of their life.
There was the whole thing with the two of them showing up on stage got a lot of press coverage, right? Like LA Times, Rolling Stone did an interview with me the next day, and that got published on their website, and LA Times picked it up and some other stuff. There's a website called Under the Radar. It's undertheradarmag.com. And Chris Enns, I'll send you the link to this so you can put it in the show notes. And so they wrote about a story about Edge and Adam Clayton surprise U2 cover band on stage at Fansite Party. And the second paragraph, this is how famous Chris Endrinal is. It says, as you can see in the fan shot video below, the crowd lost it. You can hear one fan repeatedly say, oh my God, when he works out what's happening.
Yep, that's me. That's me. And I saw actually one of the first comments on our YouTube video of it is, at about a minute 30, when I first start saying, oh my God, the commenter says, and at a minute 30, some guy wakes up.
Yeah, I just noticed that. 140 is actually one minute 40, but man wakes up. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. It was crazy. You know, it was just a moment of unadulterated joy, really.
Yeah. And that's what I think is so, like, why I think even as at U2 readers and fans, and just U2 fans in general who watch this, it's like a universal experience of like, that is exactly what I would be doing as well in that moment. Cause you'd just be like, that's not really that. No, that's like, that's gotta be the fake Edge. There's no way the Edge is actually right here in front of me. Like, and just your mind kind of trying to wrap yourself around that is like, no, this isn't happening, but it is.
Yeah. It was surreal.
I didn't say it out loud, but I was thinking everything that Chris said. So, I mean, it's the perfect reaction. It's like, no.
There were lots of things that the mic didn't pick up, thankfully. It's definitely not safe for work.
Right. Yeah, there you go. So any other comments on the party itself, Christopher, from your perspective, that besides obviously the stuff that Sherry mentioned and what we've been chatting about right now, but anything else that stood out for you?
Just the entire experience about being in a small venue like that with fans, with diehard fans, you know, fans who know this band intimately. It's a very different experience from being in an arena or being in a stadium, you know, being close to lots of other people who are into this music and into this band. It's a great community. It was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to close the book on that discussion anyways for now. I know probably people outside the At U2 community are like sick of us already talking about the party. Yeah. And we'll reference it every now and then. Christopher now is in the At U2 email group. His signature is just OMG.
Yeah.
So, which helps to determine all the different Chris's apart.
Totally.
Yeah. So that's great. Now, moving on to the other topic for the roundtable is the last few shows in New York, which we never actually got around to discussing last episode because we were just too busy OMGing about the party. Christopher, you had the unique experience of this being your first two shows of the tour, or first two shows seeing U2? I don't think.
First two shows of the tour.
Okay. Yeah, we're the last two.
There were shows 7 and 8 for me.
Right.
Total. Yep.
So talk a bit about what that was like, I guess, and sort of your expectations going in. And yeah, I don't want to preload you with statements, but
sure. No. Well, when the tour was announced, I was a little crestfallen because I thought initially that I wouldn't get to go see this, and you know, I tried to talk myself into feeling okay about it, but you know, when U2's on tour, the only thing that U2 fans want to do is go see U2, obviously. And as the tour started, and as I started reading about the show and watching some videos, I the itch really got to me, and things ended up working out that I was able to fly to New York to catch these last two shows. And it was, you know, it's one thing to read about it, and it's another thing to see videos and hear audio of it. But it's another thing entirely to be in the arena, to see and hear and experience the show. It is sensory overload, really. So I think you have to see this thing more than once, and it's helpful, I think, to see it from multiple perspectives, as I got to do for the last two shows. I was in GA for the seventh show, and I was up on the Chase Bridge for the eighth show, and it's almost like two different shows, being so close in GA and then being up in the stands for the last show. They were both great experiences, but very, very different.
Yeah, that's where we've discussed on previous episodes, trying to figure out for folks who maybe are seeing one show only. Obviously, in a perfect world, you'd see many shows, all the shows, or whatever.
Right, right.
But if you had to pick between the two, I guess, and you're only able to get hit one show, where do you sit?
Personally, I would sit farther back. The screen is amazing, and it's hard not to look at the screen. You know, and you want to look at the band and see what they're doing. But the visuals are so captivating. But it's not just the screen. It's the stage layout. It's the theatrics of Bono doing his Bono thing on the E stage while the other three members are on the I stage. Because there's so much going on, I think if you have only one show to see, I think, at least from my perspective, seeing it farther back so that you can take in everything all at once. And then if you're lucky enough to get to see a second, third, or, you know, multiple shows, then start moving closer. But for me, I thought I had a much better experience from afar.
How about you, Matt? Just to I know you've commented on this before, but
Yeah, I'm in all my experiences are down on the GA floor, and I would love to see it from the seats. I've never seen, other than on video or photos, I have never seen the yellow E stage lit up, you know, with that lighting. I've never seen the lights that are on any of the stages. I've seen obviously the screen. I've seen the lights that hang from above the stage, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I agree 100% with what Chris said. And I'm glad too that he said that about how it's different. Watching the videos and listening to the live streams and all that sort of stuff, and then it's totally different being in the arena, because it's like, you know, I would go to a show and get done after the show, and then I'd try to catch up on all the stuff that people are saying on Twitter, and I see people on Twitter saying, oh, you know, this set list didn't do anything for me, this show was boring, and I'm like, this show was fantastic. You know, you have to be in there. I don't think if you're not in the room, I don't think you have any business,
right,
you know, judging the show on how good or bad it was, because it's fantastic in the room.
I could not agree more. And that's part of the beauty of live musical performance, right? Regardless of genre, you know, whether it's classical, whether it's country, whether it's hip hop, whether it's U2, you know, we go to live shows for the experience of a live show, to be in a room or a stadium or an arena with lots of other people, focusing on this one band, and it's really loud, it's raucous, and you know, that's the point. The point isn't necessarily to dissect set lists or you know, whatever. It's to be in the moment, as Bono said on that last show, and to feel the music, not just to hear the music, not just to see the band, but to feel it, to physically feel it in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also the second or the first show you saw was the one with the, which I don't think we ever talked about on the podcast, was the one with the sort of incident or whatever with the bike. So how, talk about that as somebody who's in the audience. So yeah, just for people who aren't aware, Bono, the person who sort of rescued, quote unquote, rescued Bono when he fell off his bike and hurt his arm and had to have serious surgery and stuff, was at the show along with some of the firefighters who also came eventually to, you know, help him, obviously, as you would, not because he was Bono, but just because that's what people do to help people or whatever. But anyways, take it from there, Christopher.
Yeah, well, I was actually pretty close to the firefighters and pretty close to the woman who made the call. And, you know, I thought at first it was great because Bono was saluting the firefighters. The firefighters even, you know, handed Bono a cup of Jameson, and Bono was sipping as they were talking. You know, the firefighters took the mic, and they were great. You know, they were on the mic for about 20 seconds. And the Bono gave the mic to the lady, and I thought, you know, it was going to be a sweet little 15, 20, 30-second shout-out to Bono, whatever. But things went off the rails in a hurry. She didn't say the right thing in the right place at all. I don't think she meant to insult New York and New Yorkers.
Oh, I do.
But she did.
I do.
And it did not go over well. And if people have read read coverage about that said that the booze drowned her out, it's true. I was probably 20 feet away from her on the floor, and the booze were loud. Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, she shouldn't have said what she said.
Bono will never give the mic away again. It's
no.
I mean, that's, look, I you know, my background is in TV broadcasting, and I used to do TV news and radio and all this sort of stuff. And that's like one of the first rules they teach you, you know, when you're in journalism class, is you don't ever hand the microphone over to the person, to another person, because the minute you do that, you lose control. So Bono learned his lesson. He'll never do it again.
Yeah. You know, and it's that Bono was trying to show love to her, of course. And
yeah,
and
he was.
Bono was also trying to show that he trusts the audience. And in the Raleigh show at 360, he handed the mic to somebody and he said, "Dude, be cool." And my wife and I were, well, she was my girlfriend at the time, who's not my wife. We were at that show, and we looked at each other, and we gave each other a look saying, "Oh boy, here we go." Because we knew that this could go one of two ways. Either it could be really cool, or it could be a train wreck. That show in Raleigh, that guy was really cool.
Yeah.
In New York, the woman was not.
That's right. I'm glad. That's right. I totally forgot about that. But I remember also being amazed when he sort of tossed the microphone to the guy, like, you know, two or three rows back, you know, on the thing. Yeah, that was a cool moment. And yeah. You're good.
You know,
good.
It was cool to see someone of Bono's stature, you know, frontman of the biggest band in the world, openly trusting the audience to be cool. And I don't know if he'll ever do that again because the trust was broken. It was, you know, and it only takes one to break the trust.
Yeah. So. Were you able to see, like, was there, because it's amazing to me that it went on as long as it did and that they didn't just like kill her mic or, you know, Bono, like obviously he didn't want to make a big scene by trying to grab the mic back or something and try to give her a chance to not hang herself, so to speak, with what she's saying. But was it like awkward? I don't know. Did you look over at the edge or anybody else and just kind of see like what's going on? Or
well, Larry was face palming because
yes,
Larry couldn't believe. Edge was kind of making a face like goo, and Bono even mouthed to himself, "Well, note to self." Thinking, you know, I'm thinking that he made a note to himself saying, "Ooh, I probably shouldn't be doing this."
Yeah, I was positioned on like halfway in between the main stage and the E stage. So, and I was on Edge's sides, the south side. And so I remember at one point, Bono had his back to me while he is, you know, looking at the fireman and looking at the girl and they're talking. And I remember at one point, Bono turned around to look towards Larry and the Edge, and he just had this look on his face like, "Oh my gosh, I really screwed up."
Yep.
So it was, yeah, it was very awkward, and they knew that it was turning south pretty quickly.
Yep. Thank goodness they played Elevation afterwards, because you know, her comments ground the show to a halt. I mean, it stalled all momentum, and so, you know, the crowd felt that too, and so the band felt that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And so they played a rousing rendition of Elevation. So they did a good job of getting the show back on track.
Yeah, you can only imagine the conversation Larry would have had with Bono after that.
Oh, man. Right? Can you imagine?
He must have been just dying inside. But they also did a couple other notable mentions, you know, obviously New York, and people have probably seen all this, but having revisiting the Zoo TV Satellite of Love duet, faux duet with Bono and Lou Reed, and then Paul Simon obviously coming on as well. and then Bruce Springsteen in the final show. And is there sort of a, when you're there, an expectation that these things are going to happen and you're looking for celebrities who are going to pop up on stage or whatever, or is it just kind of a nice surprise when that happens?
Well, for me, it's kind of like with the anniversary party. You always hope something cool is going to happen, but to expect it is to set yourself up for failure. However, that being said, the rumors were so strong about Bruce coming up on stage for that last night. That, you know, I did kind of expect it. And then when he referenced Springsteen's lyrics earlier in the show, we're all like, okay, then Bruce is definitely going to come out.
Right, but, exactly.
but you know, again, it's managing your expectations as an audience member, you know, which is hard to do for a band like U2 because they consistently shatter expectations. You know, they always raise the bar for themselves. So, you know, I always hope for something cool. I always hope for a neat celebrity shout out or even performance, but never do I expect it.
Yeah. That's where I guess for my perspective on those shows or that idea is like when I've seen them live, it's been in Edmonton. I referenced in a previous episode at a football stadium and in Canada anyways, in Edmonton. The likelihood of some famous person happening to be at the show, not putting down Edmonton, but just, and there's places in the US too, in Europe, where it's like, you're so far away from anybody, anywhere. Like right. The biggest star power was like referencing a hockey player who picked up Bono hitchhiking or something like that. And that's like this as famous or whatever as we got, but that's, which is good. It was still a good show, but it definitely wasn't Bruce Springsteen coming up on stage with.
Yeah. Right.
Two. So
right. Bruce was just the icing on the cake. That last show was outstanding. It was really, really good. The seventh show I thought was good, but the vibe and the vibe in the GA audience that night was a little weird for me.
It so was.
That's also part of the reason why I prefer watching this tour from afar. I mean, that last show I sang every word. I mean, I probably yelled every word, and I was hoarse for another 4 days after that because I was so into it. It was an outstanding concert.
Did you slip in at least one OMG?
Oh, yeah, probably.
Zing. I love it.
One thing I've mentioned that we've had questions from folks about: are they coming back? What's going to happen? Is there going to be more tours in North America, et cetera? More of this tour in North America. U2's official website and social media accounts, et cetera, sent out a message thanking the U.S. and Canada. I'm just reading from tours.atu2.com, also telling fans in those countries to see you soon. So so there's obviously signs pointing to them coming back again, and everything's hopeful.
Oh, for sure. So yeah.
It makes sense they will.
I don't think there's any question that they're going to be back in North America next year. It's just a matter of whether it's, you know, when it is. Is it the spring, summer, fall? Who knows? But I think it's guaranteed they're going to be back.
Yeah,
hopefully they'll play in cities, you know, and I think we talked about this in the last podcast. Hopefully they'll play in cities, you know, down in Chris's area, you know, Florida, Atlanta, you know, all the areas, the South and the Southeast that they didn't hit at all on this tour.
Yeah, save Christopher a flight or
a
flight.
Yeah, seriously. I will gladly road trip 2 hours to see you two or 5 hours even. Yeah, totally.
I can empathize with that exactly. So cool. I think that wraps up, I think, our discussion. Anything else on the docket, Matt, that I'm forgetting as far as our roundtable?
No, I don't think so. I think we covered it.
Cool. All right. Well, as far as what's coming up on the At U2 podcast, we don't know. We're still planning the next few episodes.
We had a promise from Scott Aukerman. Is he the one that?
Yeah, I was going
to
say
from Are You Talking to U2? After they posted their podcast with their interview with U2, I used our Twitter account and said, you know, the obvious next step is that we have to get Scott and Scott on the At U2 podcast to talk about their podcast. And Scott Aukerman was all like, yeah, let's totally do it. And then Adams. Yeah. Or Adam Scott, that's right. Yeah, I always want to call him Scott Adams for some reason. He hasn't responded yet, so we need to clearly put more pressure on them.
Yeah, so I referenced the tweet in the show notes so folks can go see it, and then maybe, you know, just happen to mention, you know, at mention Scott Aukerman or Mr. Adam Scott on Twitter and just say, hey, it'd be great to see you guys, you know, pass the love down the celebrity chain, wherever we are, somewhere down the chain. That's what I tweeted at them both, saying, like, I hope you don't mind slumming it on Skype, because we don't have the full studio that we're actually going to be in together. But yeah, so who knows? We'll see. But yeah, we do have lots of other stuff we're going to be talking about, segment ideas and roundtable discussions, plenty before the tour starts up again in September. So we will definitely be back again next week with another episode. And yeah, previewing the European tour and having just sort of a roundtable discussion on what we think might happen and stuff like that. There's nothing notable on the YouTube calendar right now. You can always check the @u2.com site. There's a YouTube calendar there for tour dates for tribute bands and dates in the U2 family events and things happening. So other than that, I'll just mention, I guess, this show can be found at a few different places. goodstuff.fm/@u2 is where the podcast lives. This is episode 5, so you can put a /5 afterwards to see links that we discussed and play the podcast right on the old internet there. And you can also follow @u2 on Twitter, @u2. The hashtag we used for questions earlier in the episode that you can submit your questions to is #AskAtU2. And those will show up if you post them on Twitter, and we'll use them in future episodes. We really appreciate everybody who's submitting questions. It's fun to have that interactive element to the podcast, and we love sort of using that as a springboard to discussion. So keep those coming. You can also ask questions on the Facebook page, facebook.com/atu2com is where you can find that. I think that's everything, Matt. Anything else in closing?
No. Awesome. I'm glad we got to chat with Christopher about his OMG experience tonight.
glad I could provide some more insights besides those three words.
They're important three words, but yeah, it was good to have you fill in a bit more color, I guess.
There you go.
This episode. So, thanks, Christopher, and I'm sure you'll be back again in future episodes. And thank you, folks, for listening. And until next time, have a great day. See you later. Bye.
Do I have to answer that again?